Disclaimer: the following season 6 finale episode of 90s Crime Time talks about crimes against children and sexual assault. Listener's discretion is highly advised. Hello. It's December 23rd, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is a season 6 finale of 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome again to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and you are looking forward to the holidays, if you celebrate the holidays, and looking forward to your weekend. And as I mentioned before, today is finally the season 6 finale of 90s Crime Time. I know it's been dragging for several months now, but here it is, the finale right before the show's holiday break, and I want to go ahead and let you know that, unlike many of the other episodes, I don't have much background information on the victims and criminals in this case, but I do have enough to give you the full story. Also, as I mentioned before, the show began, today's case will talk about crimes against children and sexual assault. Therefore, again, listener's discretion is highly advised. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1994. And in the city of Richmond, Virginia, this city was at the crossroads of old Southern heritage and the new era of the 1990s, changing socially, politically, and economically, all while facing challenges. For one, while most of Richmond still carried a strong Southern and conservative identity, many parts of the city had already begun to modernize. Old tobacco warehouses were being converted into loft apartments and bars. Also, the city's downtown and Chaco Bottom neighborhood was becoming more of a nightlife and restaurant center, especially for the younger crowd. Speaking of the younger crowd, hip-hop and R&B were strong in the youth scene, alongside the early 90s alternative rock wave. However, reports state that while a lot of Richmond was updating, many of the city's neighborhoods were still battling certain issues. The city's East End and parts of Northside struggled with homicides, drug trafficking, and property crime. Also, other parts of the city had heavy gang activity as well, and many residents all around felt an economic inequality between neighborhoods. However, despite many in the city fighting over economic inequality and battling for better neighborhoods, the entire city came to a pause when, in the fall of 1994, a heinous crime took place in one of the city's troubled neighborhoods. The crime was so bad that it involved multiple innocent victims. And after it happened, it would have the city ready to find out who did it and why. In the following case, you'll find out about the crime, the victims, the investigation, and the aftermath in a case I title Night of No Mercy. Thank you. On the early morning of October 14th, 1994, in Richmond, Virginia, the city's infamous Gilpin Court housing project was at a surprising calm. According to reports, Gilpin Court was the oldest housing project in the city, having been built in the 1940s. Originally, the complex was built in response to the poverty-stricken individuals in the formerly named Apostletown neighborhood as a form of low-income housing. However, after Interstates 95 and 64 cut through the neighborhoods Gilpin surrounded, it separated residents from the rest of the neighborhood, causing economic and community destruction and limiting access to services. Due to this, over the following decades, Gilpin Court, despite having several thousand residents by the 1980s, started to self-destruct with high poverty rates and socioeconomic challenges well above city averages. There was also chronic underfunding for the complex by this time, leading into the 90s, which meant that for many of the residents, they had to resort to whatever to make money, which often included drug dealing, which many times led to murder. However, by 1994, some good fortune arrived at Gilpin Court when the property manager was awarded a quote-unquote weed and seed grant, which increased police patrols and social programs for the residents. This effort helped reduce many of the issues Gilpin Court faced, although some crime, mainly drug dealing, still occurred. Overall, many residents felt safe living there, mainly because of the increased police presence, and 911 calls became less frequent. But despite the calmer atmosphere at Gilpin Court, on that rainy morning of October 14, 1994, emergency personnel received a call they weren't expecting from a younger resident of the complex. According to reports, around 9:30 a.m., emergency personnel received a call from a 14-year-old girl who said she lived at Gilpin Court, Apartment C, and that her name was Tamika Jones. And she said she and her family had all been shot. As emergency personnel raced to the complex to help Tamika, they arrived at the scene and prepared to assist her. But when they made their way inside, there was a gory and unimaginable sight. Not only had Tamika been shot, but so had every member of her immediate family. According to reports, when help got to the scene, they found Tamika, who was 7 months pregnant, and her younger sister, 20-month-old Kenya, suffering from gunshot wounds, and they were rushed to the hospital. Back at the apartment, however, for the rest of Tamika's family, there was nothing emergency personnel could do, as her mother, 29-year-old Daphne Jones, her father, 35-year-old James Randolph, her sister, 9-year-old Nicole Jones, and her brothers, 4-year-old David and 3-year-old Robert, had all been shot dead. At the hospital, doctors determined that the baby girl Tamika was carrying, a girl she planned to name Vinay, also did not survive. And she said all of the carnage was caused by the father of her baby, 20-year-old Christopher Goins, and he was on the run. According to reports, not much is known publicly about Christopher Cornelius Goins' early life, but what is known is that he was born into unfortunate circumstances, with a mother who was addicted to drugs, who even used in front of Christopher and her other children, and who allegedly never showed her children love. Christopher also grew up watching an aunt and uncle sell and use drugs as well. And once authorities found out what was going on, Christopher was sent to live with his grandmother in New York City when he was 12. Here in New York City, reports claim this was when Christopher finally felt loved by a family member. But when his grandmother died shortly after he moved in with her, it devastated him. After her death, Christopher was said to have bounced from New York to Virginia, and to make himself self-sufficient, he started to sell drugs, and found his biggest profit came from Gilpin Court. Reports state that Christopher slowly started building a business selling cocaine and crack cocaine here, gaining multiple customers. And by 1989, Christopher began to allegedly get closer to one family who befriended and also sometimes bought product from him. And they were the Jones family, who lived in Apartment C. Reports state the family knew Christopher sold drugs, but Daphne Jones trusted him around her family anyway. At the Jones household, however, Christopher was said to not be the only dealer supplying the family. According to reports, young Tamika got so nervous with all the alleged dealings going on in the home that she reportedly wanted to move out of the apartment and in with an aunt. But before she could get any further with that idea, reports state that Tamika got closer to Christopher. And despite her only being 12 and he being around 18 or 19, they developed a sexual relationship. Tamika was apparently able to hide this from her parents, but she did tell a friend or two. However, as their sexual relationship continued, by 1993, Tamika learned that she was not, of course, Christopher's only sexual partner. And she discovered that he'd been spending a lot of time with another young woman he openly claimed was his girlfriend. And her name was Monique Littlejohn. Like Christopher, not much is publicly known about Monique. But what is known is that she was around the same age as Christopher and spent several years living back and forth between Virginia and D.C. It's unclear when she and Christopher met or began dating. But what is known is that by 1993, she believed Christopher was faithful to her until she learned about Tamika and became upset. However, she continued to see Christopher, and he continued to see Tamika sexually. Reports state, however, that although Christopher may have thought he had both situations under control, what he wasn't expecting by March 1994 was Tamika telling him that she had become pregnant by him, and she was only 14 years old. We'll continue with what happened next after a short break. According to reports, after Tamika found out she was pregnant, she obviously panicked and didn't know what to do. What would her parents think? What would Christopher think? Reports state, though, that when Tamika told Christopher, he seemed pleased about the pregnancy. But Tamika was not, and told him she wanted to have an abortion. Christopher, at first, respected her wishes and told her he'd give her the money for the operation. But he never did, and due to this, Tamika decided to keep the baby. It's unclear what her parents thought about her pregnancy, but what is known is that Tamika allegedly kept the father of the baby a secret. However, what Tamika didn't know yet was that at the same time she was pregnant with Christopher's baby, Monique was pregnant as well. But reports state that over a few months, she miscarried and also had an emergency abortion due to complications, leaving her upset. And when she found out Tamika was pregnant and that Tamika's pregnancy continued to be somewhat successful, she became very jealous. According to reports, in June 1994, Monique learned who some of Tamika's friends were and told them to beat Tamika up to cause Tamika to have a spontaneous abortion. When Tamika learned this and confronted Monique about their claims, she admitted they were true and said she only tried to get them to beat her up because she was upset she was pregnant and not her, and that she didn't mean for them to actually hurt her. However, reports state, although Monique claimed she was bluffing, on another occasion when she ran into Tamika, she was angry and told her, quote unquote, "If I can't have a baby by Christopher, you won't either." Another time, Monique reportedly went near Tamika's family's apartment, and when Tamika saw her, she allegedly saw Monique with a knife and ran back inside. Monique was said to have then sent a friend over to the apartment to scold her for running back inside. And shortly after this incident, Tamika heard that Monique said, quote unquote, "That bitch makes me upset. I'll cut that baby out of her stomach." Despite the threats, however, Tamika tried to keep her pregnancy as safe as possible. And eventually, the threats from Monique stopped. But by July 1994, she began to have pregnancy complications. Over the next few months, she was admitted a few times to Medical College of Virginia, the same place Monique worked. According to reports, Monique worked as a housekeeper at the hospital, and when she learned that Tamika had been admitted for the first time, she tried to build a fake rapport. She acted friendly towards Tamika, spending free time with her in her hospital room, asking if she needed anything delivered, asking about the baby. But Tamika didn't believe she was being sincere. By October 1994, as stated before, Tamika had been in and out of the hospital. But when she was admitted on October 11th, Monique's fake demeanor changed. By now, Tamika was 7 months pregnant, and when Monique found out she was admitted again, reports state she went to her room several times, taunting her and telling her things like Christopher didn't want anything to do with the baby. Monique also apparently told Tamika that she and Christopher planned to go to New York, where Christopher's sick father lived, to start a new life. She finally told Tamika on October 12th, the day of her discharge, that because of their planned move, she needed to find someone else to love her and help her care for her child. Reports state, though, that despite dealing with Monique, Tamika wasn't alone with her concerns. Her parents, Daphne and James, knew about the threats. Still, it's unclear whether they correlated Monique threatening Tamika with Tamika dealing with the much older Christopher. But on the morning of October 14th, 1994, when Christopher went to the Jones apartment to meet with the family, all hell would break loose. We'll be right back after another break. Shortly after her discharge from the hospital, a conflict between Tamika and Christopher occurred. It's unclear what the exact conflict was. Still, all evidence suggests Monique confronted Christopher about his unborn baby with Tamika, and that in a short span between October 12th and 14th, Christopher became angry and bothered by the pregnancy. According to reports, on the morning of October 14th, 1994, a mutual friend of the Jones family and Christopher named Barry Scott visited the Jones home. When he came across Tamika's bedroom, he saw her playing with her younger siblings. They had a quick chat, and he noticed an ultrasound of her baby. Barry then left and came back with Christopher, who allegedly was there only to visit and possibly sell some drugs. When the men came back to the apartment, Barry showed Christopher the ultrasound picture. But instead of showing joy, he became irritated and told Barry, quote unquote, "I don't want to see that. Take it back to her. Why are you showing me that?" When Barry returned the picture to Tamika, she confronted him and told him that she didn't want Christopher to see the ultrasound because she knew there was rising tension about him and the pregnancy. Shortly after the friend left, Christopher stayed, and Tamika noticed him sitting on the couch when she went to the bathroom. They made eye contact, but they did not speak. Tamika then went back to her bedroom and heard her parents and Christopher talk about Monique's confrontation with her. He brushed off their concerns, and then the adults continued to talk and laugh. And by this point, her siblings were spread throughout the home. However, several minutes after she left the bathroom, Tamika abruptly heard gunshots. Reports state she heard her brother crying, her mother scream, more shots, and footsteps of one person walking to the bedrooms. The sound of gunfire continued and got closer to her bedroom. And when she heard footsteps at her door, she looked up and there was Christopher, who immediately began pumping several shots into her body, mostly in her belly. She then ran to cover her baby sister Kenya, then remained still and pretended to be dead. And when she heard no more shots and felt the coast was clear, she called the police. At the scene, emergency personnel came across the bodies of her 4-year-old brother David, as well as the bodies of her parents, Daphne and James. In one of the bedrooms, they discovered the body of her 9-year-old sister, Nicole, who had stayed home from school that day, recovering from strep throat, as well as the body of their 3-year-old brother, Robert. All had received lethal wounds to their heads and other gunshot wounds all over their bodies, except for baby Kenya, who was shot in her left wrist, and Tamika, who was shot everywhere else but her head. After Tamika was rushed to the hospital, she underwent emergency surgery to try and save her 7-month-old fetus. But it was too late. Baby Vinay was dead as well. And because multiple bullets had perforated her uterus, her right ovary, and her fallopian tube, Tamika had to undergo an emergency hysterectomy, meaning she would never be able to bear children again. After Tamika was stable and told police who shot her and her little sister and killed the rest of her family, the hunt was on for Christopher. Back at the scene, residents of Gilpin Court, who'd mostly been used to gun violence, were horrified after they learned of the massacre, and many openly cried after seeing the bodies being removed. One neighbor told the press at the scene that she was shocked since the family didn't seem to bother anyone, and that Daphne, the matriarch, mainly kept to herself, but that they frequently saw her watch over her children when they played outside. Other residents told the press they couldn't understand why the killer didn't spare the children, and when they learned Christopher was named as the killer, many were shocked to hear that as well. You see, although he sold narcotics throughout the complex, many viewed Christopher as a nice man. He'd offer rides to many of the residents, and he'd take many of their children to school. But now that he was accused of almost killing an entire family, most around Gilpin Court wanted him caught, with some wishing them he'd get the death penalty. They also said that after Christopher was caught, they'd be able to sleep better. However, as police searched for Christopher, detectives received a tip that he was in a relationship with a woman named Monique Littlejohn, and that they should talk to her for answers about his whereabouts. Detectives caught up with Monique as she was headed to work on the afternoon of October 14th. Reports state that when the police told her of the shootings, Monique went with them for questioning. During questioning, Monique claimed she had not seen Christopher that day, had recently moved to get away from him, and that she did not know where he lived. When detectives asked for permission to search her apartment, she allowed them to, and reports state that inside they found men's clothing and various handgun publications, including a manual for the operation of a Glock 45 caliber automatic. Detectives also saw a safe which Monique told them falsely was in the apartment before she moved in. Inside the safe, police found Monique's social security card, birth certificate, and other identification. But one identification was bearing a photograph of Christopher with the name Derek Reedon, an alias he frequently used. In her car, detectives saw Monique's driver's license and another identification card bearing a photograph of Christopher with the name Derek Reedon. But after the search, they let Monique go. But a few days later, detectives received a call from Monique's mother, who said she found a 45 caliber cartridge underneath Monique's bed. When detectives retrieved the cartridge, firearms experts concluded that the unspent cartridge had been loaded at some time into the same magazine that held the bullets used to kill the Jones family. After gathering all this information, the police were ready to arrest Christopher and possibly Monique for the shooting. But shortly after they went to talk to Monique again, she too had disappeared. As the hunt was on for the couple on October 21st, 1994, around 3,000 people attended the Jones family mass funeral held at a community center, where six white caskets lined the gym. Tamika, who attended in a wheelchair, sat across from her seven-month-old, not full-term baby Vinay, and left shortly before the service was over. Many attendees thought that although the circumstances of the funeral were horrible, they felt it brought the community together. Although some were dismayed that many of Richmond's white residents did not attend. After the funeral, though, many residents of Richmond were waiting impatiently for Christopher and possibly Monique to be brought to justice. However, despite some tips from residents about where the couple might be, police were at a standstill for several days. So, reports state that they decided to bring the case to the TV show America's Most Wanted, which profiled Christopher and the crime in a 6-minute segment aired on November 5th, 1994. And after the segment aired, more than 100 tips came into the police. And 12 days later, on November 17th, 1994, a tip came into the Richmond police saying that Christopher and Monique were hiding in an apartment in New York. and after gathering information from this potential source, Richmond and New York authorities, along with federal agents, zoomed in on the apartment. On that morning, SWAT teams surrounded and entered the unit and arrested the couple. There was also another couple in the unit, later identified as Christopher's half-brother and his girlfriend, but they were not charged. After they were arrested, Monique was charged with an unrelated drug charge. Christopher was charged with 5 counts of capital murder, only 5 counts, since he could not be charged for the unborn baby's death, as Virginia law, at least at that time, prohibited murder charges of an unborn child. And they were both charged with unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. After Christopher and Monique were caught, many in the city of Richmond, especially at Gilpin Court, rejoiced. With one woman telling the press, quote unquote, "We can really sleep at night, you know. He is not out there doing something to somebody else." Also, shortly after the arrests, Barry turned himself into the police. Not because he had committed a crime, but because he wanted to assure them he had nothing to do with the massacre. Nor did he know it was going to happen. However, police arrested him anyway and charged him as an accessory before the fact. Barry was held on a $5,000 bond, and after he paid it, he stayed away from Gilpin Court. However, reports state that months later, in June 1995, Barry went back to Gilpin for unknown reasons, and when he did, he was shot several times. Allegedly by a man with the name of Kevin Winston, who was said to be related to Christopher. According to reports, while most in Gilpin Court wanted Christopher to face justice, he still had some loyal people behind him who allegedly still lived there, and some of his supporters thought Barry was working with detectives and snitching. Therefore, that was why he was shot. Barry claimed, however, that he was not snitching and didn't know the man who shot him. Meanwhile, after Christopher and Monique were taken into custody, police also charged Monique's mother with aiding the couple after learning she drove them to New York to hide out shortly after the murders. She even falsely reported Monique missing 2 days after the massacre. While everyone charged in the case was waiting for their day in court, reports state that Tamika and Kenya were held in witness protection until the trials were over. Also during this time, reports state that while Monique was in jail, officials received a tip from one of her cellmates who said Monique knew about the massacre and that when she asked if the rumors were true, that she had once threatened Tamika, Monique allegedly smirked and nodded yes. With this information, prosecutors also charged Monique Littlejohn with being an accessory before the killings. We'll continue with the finality of the story after a final break. At her trial in mid-1995, prosecutors alleged Monique was angry about Tamika's involvement with Christopher and that she was pregnant, and badgered Christopher about it. They then alleged that she may not have actually committed the massacre, but she certainly didn't stop it and knew it was going to happen. Prosecutors also called Monique's cellmate to the stand, and she testified that Monique confided in her. She testified that Monique said, quote unquote, "Police are really out to get her." She also testified that Monique told her that the police had found a gun which had been discarded and that she was worried because she did not know if her fingerprints were on the gun. She further testified that Monique told her Barry Scott said that Christopher had killed people and that Monique knew about it. Monique's former cellmate also confirmed that Monique smirked and acknowledged that she threatened Tamika in the past and that Monique was angry about the quote-unquote other girl and had several run-ins with her because the girl was saying she was carrying Christopher's baby. The woman lastly testified that Monique said she had waited in her car parked near the Jones apartment for Christopher on October 14, 1994, and that she and Christopher left together. And that Monique said, quote-unquote, one little mistake had ruined her whole life, but did not know the nature of Monique's quote-unquote mistake. Meanwhile, Christopher's trial was also in progress, and prosecutors opened by saying that Monique was upset about Tamika's pregnancy, and Christopher eliminated the problems. Over the next several weeks, they called to the stand several witnesses, including a taxi driver who knew Christopher personally and drove him around frequently, who said shortly before the murders, Christopher complained about Tamika and her family and that he wanted to harm them. However, he said he didn't take him seriously until the week of the murders, and he asked him to take him to New York, but the cab driver refused. Prosecutors alleged that this was when Christopher and Monique approached her mother to drive them to New York, and she agreed. Others called to the stand were other Gilpin Court residents and even other drug dealers who stated they witnessed Christopher around the Jones apartment speaking to several different people, including Barry Scott. One Gilpin Court resident said that on the morning of the murder, he drove a dealer to the apartment to sell to the family. But when they saw Christopher, they left, as they knew Christopher was also another dealer and didn't want to interfere with his potential business and cause conflict. So they drove to a nearby store. At the store, they got some food, and shortly after, they witnessed Monique drive up. Then they saw Christopher walk past the store, speak to another man, and get into the car with Monique, then drive away. With all of this information and evidence of Tamika's phone call, and after she even testified, prosecutors rested their case, and jurors in Christopher and Monique's trials deliberated. In June 1995, Christopher Goins was found guilty and later sentenced to death. Monique Littlejohn was also found guilty and sentenced to 178 years. Later, Barry Scott was found guilty as an accessory before the fact and sentenced to 7 years. Monique's mother was also later found guilty of her charges, but it's unclear what her sentence was. After the verdicts and sentencing, many residents of Gilpin Court rejoiced and were happy with what Christopher and Monique received. Also, some of the victims' family members expressed their gratitude, with Daphne Jones' mother, Jean, saying, quote-unquote, "Now my children can rest in peace, and my granddaughter can start getting our life together. He didn't get no more than he deserved." The family of James Randolph also expressed their joy with the verdict, although his father was opposed to the death penalty. Eventually, Tamika Jones was transferred to a private school, and family members raised her little sister, Kenya. However, in 1997, shockingly, Monique appealed her verdict, and her sentence was overturned. This was because her attorney argued that on the day of the murders, he hypothesized that Christopher was in the apartment talking and laughing with the victims for at least 30 minutes before the shooting, which suggested to him that the killings resulted from a dispute over drugs, not because Monique was upset over Tamika's pregnancy, and that Monique didn't know Christopher was going to kill them. Due to his successful argument, Monique was freed from prison. It's unclear what happened to her after she was released, but she did tell reporters shortly after she was released, quote-unquote, "I knew in the end it would be all right." Tamika went on to live in California to start over, but in the year 2000, after Christopher's death warrant was signed, she gave an interview with local press where she said, quote unquote, "I still feel bad about it. I just want him off this earth. I just want him away from here so he can go to God and let God deal with it. I don't care how they do it. I just want him to have to go and be punished." And on December 6th, 2000, Christopher Goins was led into the death chamber at the Virginia Department of Corrections. Before he was strapped into the gurney, reports state he looked around and stated, quote unquote, "Look, we've got an audience." And shortly before he was executed, he continued and said, quote unquote, "There's no God but Allah." He was then pronounced dead at 9:04 p.m. The story of the Jones family massacre at Gilpin Court comes from the sources of the Freelance Virginia, UPI, Richmond Times Dispatch, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, thank you for listening to that very brutal episode, the season finale of 90s Crime Time, season 6. And I know it was very hard for you all to listen to, for a lot of you to listen to. I won't say all of you, but a lot of you, because any crime against children, innocent victims, is horrible. And I do believe Daphne and James Randolph were innocent as well. I have a few things to say, not too many because it was already a lengthy episode. But number one, I realize that, let me go ahead and say, I didn't really touch on Christopher's sentence towards Tamika and Kenya's attempted murders, and for that he was sentenced to several decades in prison for that. I do apologize that I did not put that in the main story, but also I wanted to touch on about the younger children's father, Robert, David, and Kenya's father. Robert, David, and Kenya's father. I'm not sure if he was Nicole's father, but Daphne had two fathers of her children, and one of them was the father of either four of her youngest children or three of her youngest children, but I'm not totally 100% sure. But he was in prison when he heard about the massacre, and no one told him anything, no one called him, but he heard about it and he realized that it was the Daphne's unit that was hit, and that people were murdered in that unit, and he had to call attention to one of the COs, correctional officers, to get any attention. He begged, he sort of started a commotion to get some attention, and the CO actually had empathy for him and got information for him, and he confirmed that his children by Daphne were the ones massacred, and that is horrible. And he did a little tribute to his sons and his children that were killed by Christopher, the ones that were not by James Randolph, the youngest ones. Again, the youngest ones, Daphne did have relations with this man and had the few youngest kids by him. And also, James Randolph was not her boyfriend at that time of the massacre, but they had relations in the past, and he was just there to visit. Also, when Christopher was captured, obviously cameras are around, and he was just smiling like he had no care in the world about what he had done. And I feel really horrible for Tamika and Kenya. They have lost their parents and their siblings, and I'm not sure if they had any other siblings that lived outside of the apartment, but either way, they lost their younger Kenya's older siblings and Tamika's younger siblings, and it's just horrible. And how, you know, Tamika had to call for help and probably saw the bodies of her family, at least at that funeral, all six of those caskets lined in front of her, including her unborn child, Vinay. It's just horrible and just barbaric. And I don't want to say whether I believe or not in the death penalty, but I just believe, you know, Christopher just, I'm glad he was just off the streets, because apparently he was a nice man to a lot of people around Gilpin and to the people who knew him personally, but he snapped. So there's something there that triggered this, and I'm not sure whether it was Monique badgering him about Tamika's pregnancy, about him getting a 14-year-old girl pregnant when he was 20. I don't know, but this is all, he snapped. He committed this carnage. Proof that he committed all this carnage. He killed innocent children. He killed Tamika's parents. I'm not sure if there was, there was like a little talk that I saw on a blog that he may have had Tamika's parents may have tried to press statutory rape charges against him. I'm not sure how they knew that he was having sex with Tamika. I'm not sure if they did know. I'm not sure if there was a statutory rape charge about to be on him. I'm not sure, but that was some talk. I'm not sure if they ever found out, Tamika's parents ever found out he had gotten Tamika pregnant. Because that's just gross, in my opinion. He started having sex with her when he was an adult and she was 12. That's disgusting. You know, Daphne and James trusted him around their daughter, and this is what happened. Tamika was trying to get away from all the dealing allegedly going on in the apartment, and you know, she got, you know, wooed by Christopher, and you know, eventually got pregnant 2 years later, and he ended up just killing them all except Tamika and baby Kenya. And going back to Barry, I'm not sure how accurate that story is about him being killed. I mean, not killed, sorry, he survived, sorry, how he was shot about around I'm so sorry, y'all. He was allegedly shot by a family member of Christopher named Kevin, and because people thought Barry was snitching. But according to Kevin's mother, he's not related to Christopher, so that's a little confusing. But reports state that Kevin did say he was Christopher's relative. But again, we don't know how accurate that is. But I did see in 1999, a man by Kevin, the same name as Kevin, middle name and last name, was killed himself in 1999. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that's the same Kevin that was accused of shooting Barry in 95. But Kevin was never really brought to justice for Barry's shooting, but apparently this Kevin was the same Kevin who was murdered himself in 1999, and that's just crazy. But going back to the Gilpin Court massacre, I don't know also if Christopher had other children of his own. I'm not sure the exact motive, like I said. And I also don't think, for me, this may be unpopular, I don't think Monique is as innocent as she claimed. I think she lucked up, because when I read she got 178 years, I was like, oh wow, for being an accessory, that's a lot. But she was brought to justice, and I do think she was really upset, obviously, that Tamika had gotten pregnant by Christopher, or Christopher had gotten Tamika pregnant. And I do think she helped him out after the massacre. I don't know what her exact role was, but I do think she has something to do with helping him after, and maybe before, I'm not sure. But I don't think she should have been released that soon. But she had a very good attorney, obviously. And we don't even know how long he was talking to Daphne and James before he started killing folks in the apartment. And I just think it's very, very horrible, very sad. And I'm glad he was brought to justice. Like I said, I'm not saying I'm for or against the death penalty, but I'm glad he was brought to justice, even if he was given life without parole. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to the season 6 finale of 90s Crime Time, and I hope you found it interesting, even though it was very, very tragic. Again, if you haven't already, please leave a hopefully nice review/rating on the podcast platform where you listen to the show. I'd really appreciate it. Stay safe and healthy. Happy holidays if you celebrate the holidays, and I will see you early next year for season 7 of 90s Crime Time.